You're listening to Central Time. I'm Dean Knetter, in for Rob Ferret. Coming up, one of the pioneering researchers on forgiveness joins us to share the personal and communal benefits of forgiveness and how we can do it better. Now, Democrats in Congress are moving forward with a plan aimed at lowering prescription drug costs. One key provision would empower Medicare to negotiate the price of certain drugs. Another would make drug makers pay rebates if they raise the cost of a prescription faster than inflation. We're taking a closer look at the proposals, what it would mean for the cost you pay for medicine, and fact-checking some of what the pharma lobby is saying about the plan. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you think Medicare should be allowed to negotiate prescription drug costs? Is it something you've been waiting on Congress to do? How do prescription drugs affect your budget, your health? If you've lived in another country and needed prescription drugs, what was that experience like? What was the cost like? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@wpr.org. Dr. John Abramson is a lecturer of healthcare policy at the Harvard Medical School and author of the book Sickening: How Big Pharma Broke American Healthcare and How We Can Repair It. He served as an unpaid consultant to the Department of Justice and FBI on a pharmaceutical case that led to the largest criminal fine in U.S. history. And he was a practicing family physician for over 20 years. Dr. Abramson, thanks for joining us today.
Dean, thanks for having me. It's a pleasure to be here.
Well, this plan by Democrats has undergone some changes over the last few months. But could you talk about, as it stands right now, how would it go about lowering prescription drug costs?
It will lower prescription drug costs on some prescriptions, and we need to talk about what it does and what it doesn't do. So the basic structure of the bill is that it will allow negotiation, price negotiation, on 10 drugs initially, going up to 20 drugs over 3 years. But these drugs are old drugs at the end of their patent life. So it will curtail the cost of those few drugs that are being price controlled, 10 drugs, 15, 20 drugs a year. But it won't do much at all for the cost of the rest of the drugs on the market. Now, one thing that it does do, which is a plus, is that it constrains the drug company's room to raise their prices to be limited to the cost of living increases. So they can't raise their prices more than inflation. But what it doesn't do, and this is huge, is it doesn't address the initial cost of the drug. And in 2020 and 2021, half of the drugs that came out cost more than $150,000 a year. $150,000 a year. That's like twice, more than twice the median household income of an American family.
So it doesn't change those initial costs. It would allow for Medicare to negotiate drug prices, as you said, on a limited number of drugs. But in general, how impactful could that idea, that practice, be on prices?
It's not going to be very impactful. The CBO says that it will cost the drug industry about $30 billion a year, which is a minuscule fraction of their total sales. So what the way we're doing it in the United States is backwards. We are allowing the drug companies to set whatever price they want on the drugs that are approved. And by definition, when a drug's approved, they have a patent on it and they have a monopoly on it, and they can market the drugs very heavily and generate those enormous prices. And then at the end of the drug life, there may be some brief period of negotiation. Other countries do it in the reverse. They evaluate the clinical value of new drugs in the beginning and set the price of the new drugs commensurate with their medical value so that the people in those countries are paying a fair price for the drug throughout the life of the drug, not just at the end of the life of the drug. And the end result of that is that Americans pay 3.5 times more for brand name drugs than people in the other OECD countries.
And if we did allow something like that front-end price control here in America. How would it work? Would it be under the aegis of the FDA or something else?
It wouldn't be the FDA. No, we need another agency. Most of the other wealthy countries have what's called a health technology assessment agency, and that agency is in charge of determining the medical value of a new drug and then participating in negotiations to set a fair price. The United States is virtually alone amongst wealthy countries in not having health technology assessment. So the truth is that it's only one out of four new drugs that is actually a significant advance over drugs that are already available. But the drug companies can price and market all four drugs. Let's imagine four drugs are approved. The drug company can price and market those drugs as if they're superior. The doctors can't know because we don't have a health technology assessment, because the medical journals that publish the peer-reviewed articles that bring the information of the doctors that they rely upon, the peer reviewers are supposed to vouch for the accuracy of the articles, but the peer reviewers don't even get to see the data. And the guideline writers who set the standards of clinical practice don't get to see the data. So we've got a situation where the drug companies are virtually in charge of setting their own prices and controlling the knowledge about their drugs and through the entire period of the patent of the drugs.
We're talking with Dr. John Abramson of Harvard Medical School about a package from Democrats in the Senate aimed at bringing down prescription drug costs. Dr. Abramson, one of those other measures in that bill that we mentioned was preventing drug companies from raising prices on drugs faster than inflation. Is that something we've been seeing, that it's been outpacing inflation, and has that had a big effect on what we're paying?
For sure, it has, and that could be meaningful, but the more important issue is that the price of new drugs has been going up 20% per year for the last 14 years. So that, as I said before, half of the new drugs that come out cost more than $150,000 a year. So it's that front-end price control that we need. We need to make sure that on the front end, Americans are charged a fair price for the value of the drug, and not just letting the drug companies charge whatever they want.
Another part of this bill, a stated goal would cap prescription costs for those receiving Medicare at $2,000 a year. How would it go about doing that?
Well, it's unclear, and I don't think that's been determined. My guess is that what they're going to do is beneficial for Medicare recipients because their out-of-pocket costs will be only $2,000. But who's going to pick up the tab? And my hunch is that there will be government subsidies that pay for the rest of what would have been the out-of-pocket costs. And this is a way to create a safety valve for Medicare recipients, which is a good thing because $2,000 is a lot of money and a lot of people are spending a lot more than that. So that's a good thing. But what we're doing is protecting high drug costs so that the seniors who are unable to afford their medicines don't create a political movement to have a more powerful bill to control the price of drugs. So it's a safety valve, but it's a safety valve that protects individuals but leaves this dysfunctional system standing.
In response to this Democratic plan, we have seen some ads run by the pharmaceutical industry in opposition to it. I want to listen to a couple of those ads right now and see what, do a little fact checking on them. The first one here is paid for by a group called Pharma, a lobbying group for the industry, all about the access to different types of medicines and what this plan would do. Here's a listen.
I'm Sue and I have type 1 diabetes. I depend on Medicare to get my medicines. It's not always easy, but I make it work. Now some in Congress want to make things even harder. They want to repeal a protection in Medicare that protects access to my medicines. They call it negotiation, but it really means the government decides what medicines I can get. That would make it harder for people on Medicare to get the medicines we need. Medicare means access. Please don't take that away.
A pharmaceutical lobby ad there against this plan from Democrats. Dr. Abramson, what do you think about kind of the case laid out in that advertisement?
I think it's just plain false. There's nothing about this bill that's going to restrict what medicines people can get. And I doubt that a pharmaceutical company is going to pull its drug off the market because it has to negotiate a fair price at the end of the patent life. I think it's important to remember that pharma represents the pharmaceutical industry. And no matter how much they try to get us to believe otherwise, the primary job of the pharmaceutical industry is to maximize the financial returns to their investors. And their lobbying and their political contributions and their PR campaigns are all designed to maximize those the returns to investors. And a little bit of history: when Medicare Part D was being negotiated back in 2003, Billy Towson was the chairman, the Republican chairman of the House Ways and Means Committee, and he's the one who put this plan in, who marshaled this plan through, that said Medicare could not negotiate prices with the drug companies. It was a huge win for the drug industry. And after that was negotiated, Billy Towson relinquished his chair in the House of Representatives and took a job working as the CEO of Pharma, the very organization that paid for that ad, at a $2 million a year salary. So this is business. This is hardball business. And they're going to hit the public. And listeners, please, please heed this. They're going to try to hit you with any message that will make you fear that the quality of your medicine, the quality of your healthcare is going to go down. If there were a plan like we were talking about before, where on the front end, fair prices were established, not the back end like this proposal, but if on the front end, fair prices were established, that would be an enormous motivation for the drug companies to make more effective medicines, because they're not going to get paid for the less effective medicines. And I think the quality of our healthcare and the information and options that doctors have to treat their patients would go up enormously if we priced drugs on the front end according to how much they're going to contribute to people's health.
We're talking with Dr. John Abramson right now, lecturer with the Harvard Medical School and author of the book, Sickening, How Big Pharma Broke American Healthcare and How We Can Repair It. He's with us today to talk about a plan in Congress that would let Medicare negotiate prescription drug costs, among other things. We want to hear what you think at 800-642-1234. Are prescription medicines too expensive for you? How does it affect your monthly budget? Have you had to make choices about what you can afford to take and what you can't afford to take? Do you think it's time drug companies face some new regulations? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can email ideas@wpr.org. We'll continue the conversation and hear from you coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Dean Kinetter. Right now, we're picking up our talk about prescription drug prices and Democratic legislation in the Senate to bring those prices down. Dr. John Abramson with the Harvard Medical School stays with us. Taking your calls as well at 800-642-1234. What has your experience been like paying for prescription drugs? What changes do you want to see in how we price them, how we interact with drug companies? 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Dr. Abramson, I want to listen to one more ad that people may have seen online, on television, from a pharmaceutical lobbying group opposing this plan. This one talking about the issue of innovation.
Government price setting could mean fewer medicines in the coming years. Which new medicines could be lost? Today, there are 90 medicines in development for Alzheimer's disease, 26 for childhood diabetes, 119 for breast cancer. The list goes on. Which diseases could go untreated if Congress passes government price setting?
I think that's an argument we've heard before, that drug companies will be less incentivized to develop new drugs. What do you think?
Well, I think it's a gross exaggeration, and I think it's an immoral scare tactic. The CNN just reported today that the structure of the bill that's currently being negotiated would lead to 15 fewer drugs being developed over 30 years. And given that one out of four new drugs is actually a significant improvement over previously available therapy, we're talking about missing out on four new drugs over a 30-year period. That doesn't mean that there won't be Alzheimer's drugs and cancer drugs and the kinds of things that we all worry about and we all have family members who are suffering from. But the evidence that there will be fewer drugs is just grossly overstated. And if the drug companies would get paid according to how beneficial their drugs really are, not how beneficial they claim they are, with, I think, the same degree of honesty as these ads have, if they got paid for the real benefit of new drugs, that would mean that we got far more effective new drugs. And that's where we ought to be focusing our attention. I'm not saying this is kind of like the drug bill that just got passed. I think we got to pass it. It's the best thing can get done. It's the political reality. It's got some benefits, and it's better to pass the bill than not pass the bill. But I am saying that we ought not to think that we're solving the cost of prescription drugs for American people and the quality of the information that doctors have about prescription drugs with this bill. It does nothing to help that problem.
And Dr. Abramson, how are drug companies spending their money right now? How much of it goes toward new drug development and how much of it goes towards things, I don't know, like marketing?
Marketing and stock buybacks. So the original bill that was passed, H.R. 3, the Elijah Cummings drug bill that was passed by the House in 2019, called for negotiating on 2.5 times more drugs than this watered-down version of it. And the CBO calculated that that would cost the drug industry $450 billion over 10 years. Sounds like a lot of money, and the drug industry went to the PR people and put out ads that it would be a nuclear winter in innovation. So that's $450 billion over 10 years. It turns out that in the 5 years between 2016 and 2020, the drug industry spent not $450 billion, but $577 billion in stock buybacks and dividends. So they've got more than four times the amount of money that this bill will cost them. They've got to pay for stock buybacks and dividends and claim and tell the untruth to the American people that this is going to cost Americans the benefit of drug innovation, when what they're doing is hoarding their money to raise the returns to their investors.
I want to go to our phones now. We have Nancy with us in Milwaukee. Nancy, hello.
Hello to you. And I'm so happy that you have this speaker on today. I am 90 years old. I have been told by my endocrinologist that I need to have an IV solution of a drug called Reclast put into my arm because I have advanced osteoporosis, and this drug will keep my bones from further deterioration. And I am very angry about this. This is going to cost me at least $1,000. The amount of the dose is based on the condition of your bones, which needs to be ascertained by having a bone density test. But this is... The speaker is so marvelous to point out to all of us that pharmacology companies own us body and soul, and I am very angry about this.
Nancy, I'm sorry to hear that, and thank you so much for calling in and sharing your experience. Dr. Abramson, what do you think about what Nancy had to say?
I say, go, girl. That's great. You got the energy. It can be a tough decision about the osteoporosis drugs. They're certainly not cure-alls. They can decrease the risk of fracture somewhat. They tend to decrease spinal fractures more than hip fractures, and the spinal fractures can be painful, but they're not as serious. But what the pharmaceutical companies not only have the patients and the lock on what the patients have to pay for their drugs, but the at least as important is they have the lock on what doctors believe they know to be the science about these drugs. They control that science. You can't get the data. It's like the data for the vaccines. You can't get the data if you're not in litigation. I've spent 10 years in litigation. I know what's in the data. I don't know about reclassed, but I know what's in the data, at least for some drugs, and it's not what doctors think it is. And that's a problem that's lurking behind all of this, is the quality of the knowledge that doctors have about the best way to take care of their patients. And now pharma virtually controls that knowledge.
Dr. Abramson, you've talked about the importance of doing what other countries do and setting those drug prices on the front end rather than negotiating. We just have a minute left, but what would it take to sort of get momentum behind that movement going here in America?
Well, we're in a near state of political paralysis, so we're far from it. But what it would take is Americans care about this. 90% of Americans think the way Nancy does. Americans care. They know they're not getting treated right by the pharmaceutical industry. The doctors are a little bit slower to be critical about what's going on, but the doctors can't bring the service to their patients the way they believe they can, because the information is so controlled by the commercial drug companies. And finally, the business owners who aren't making money on healthcare are getting ripped off, and the profitability of their corporations is getting compromised by the money that we waste on healthcare. So a coalition of 80 or 90% of Americans, of healthcare professionals, and of business owners could take this on. But it would have to be a coalition that transcended political parties and was laser focused on the quality of the information that doctors get about the drugs that they prescribe, and a rebalancing of our healthcare system to be focused on the best way to help Americans be healthy rather than to make the most money on drugs.
A big thanks to our guest, Dr. John Abramson from Harvard Medical School, talking with us today about a Democratic plan in the Senate to lower prescription drug costs. Coming up tomorrow on The Morning Show with Kate Archer Kent, we'll take a closer look at the first pictures from the James Webb Space Telescope. That's tomorrow morning on The Morning Show. I spent some time in Appleton last weekend, checked out the History Museum there and the planetarium down the road in Menasha. Something else I saw was a lot of sidewalk chalk. People in the downtown area were laying down some seriously amazing chalk art, far beyond anything I've accomplished in my chalk days. It turns out there's a lot of chalk art festivals coming up around the state. This Saturday in Eau Claire, you can catch the 2022 Chalk Fest on the UW campus there. And Kenosha is hosting a chalk festival this weekend, too. On August 13th, you'll have events in Green Bay and in Oshkosh on Opera House Square. August 20th, the Art and Chalk Fest in West Bend. And finally, on August 27th, Platteville is hosting the Chalk and Cheese Festival. Platteville, you've got me convinced. I think I'm going to be heading your way. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network. Listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Dean Knetter, in for Rob Ferret. Forgiving other people can be really difficult, but it can also be very healing, too. For a lot of us, there's a peace of mind that comes from forgiving someone or being forgiven for something. And there's a growing body of evidence that shows it can have direct benefits to our mental health and well-being. Our guest today pioneered this research as the first person to publish a scientific study on person-to-person forgiveness in 1989, and he remains at the forefront of the field. We want to hear your experiences with forgiveness at 800-642-1234. What big moments of forgiveness stick out to you in your life? Have you ever had to forgive someone for something they did wrong? What was that process like? Did you notice yourself feeling better afterward? And what does forgiveness really look like to you? Is it just letting someone know that you've forgiven them, or is there a little bit more to it than that? Tell us your story. Give us a call at 800-642-1234, and that's 800-642-1234. 1234, or you can post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Robert Enright holds the Aristotelian Professorship in Forgiveness Science within the Department of Educational Psychology at UW-Madison. He's a licensed psychologist and co-founder of the International Forgiveness Institute. Bob, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you, Dean. It's an honor to be with you.
Well, I think we all kind of understand the general concept of forgiveness, but I'm curious, as someone who has studied this for so long, is there a precise way to define it in your work?
Yes. Just like justice or patience or kindness, historically it's considered to be what we call a moral virtue or goodness toward others. And specifically, forgiveness is toward those who have been unfair to us, sometimes deeply unjust to us. And we try to do two things, to try and get rid of the animosity or the built-up anger, which can really do a number on us as the one who's been hurt, and here's where it gets controversial, deliberately offering goodness to the one who was not good to us.
And earlier this week, you spoke at an international conference here in Madison about agape love and forgiveness. Can you talk about what this concept of agape love is and how it plays into forgiveness?
Yeah, well, agape, A-G-A-P-E, is an ancient Greek term. Of course, they still use it in Greece, but it started in ancient Greece trying to distinguish different kinds of love. And there's a love like Philadelphia, it's called philia, which is mutual friendship love. But agape has come historically to be known as the kind of love that's much harder than mutuality, where you can give to others who need help, give to others when it's hard, when it's painful, and you do it anyway for the other person's sake. And that actually is seen by many people as the absolute highest form of forgiveness, but that doesn't mean if someone looks at that and says, that's ridiculous, I couldn't possibly feel and experience and give that kind of love to someone who brutalized me, I would say, of course, because we're talking a difference between where you are right now on your path of forgiving and what the highest possibility is. And we don't want to get discouraged if we're not at the highest, especially if we haven't practiced forgiveness that much in our life.
So there's acknowledging forgiveness, and then there's, as you said, doing good for that person who might have wronged us. And that does seem like the tough part. On a practical level, what does that look like? Is it kind of sending just good vibes internally, or are there acts of service? What does it look like?
Well, it all depends on the situation. Let's say we're talking with a person who's in a partnering relationship, and the other partner is very, very abusive. For us to then, who study forgiveness and use it in psychotherapy, I'm a licensed psychologist, so forgiveness is actually part of therapy, we would never say, well, to be so good, you want to go back into that relationship. Because that's not forgiveness, that's reconciliation. And reconciliation, not being a moral virtue, means you don't have to reconcile when you forgive. So being good in a situation like that might be this. You might have a kind word about the person to others. You might donate a little money to a charity in that person's name. And here's the paradox of forgiveness that many people don't understand. The paradox, of course, being an apparent contradiction, but it's not a contradiction. As you try, even for a little bit of goodness toward that other person, the built-up resentment in your own heart starts to melt away. And so you're no longer a victim of emotional abuse that you literally could carry with you for the rest of your life. And so while it seems outrageous to say, well, to be good to someone who isn't good to me, well, you're not necessarily going to reconcile. You're not abandoning justice. You can still call 911, okay? And you're definitely not excusing what the other did, because what the other did was, is, and always will be unfair. But the heroic nature of forgiveness is you try even a little bit to be good toward that other person. And we find through our science that a lot of psychological well-being visits the one who is ready and willing and chooses to forgive without being forced into it.
Yeah, when we reach that point of forgiveness, not necessarily excusing something, but when we do forgive, what are some of those trickle-down effects that you see on our well-being in general?
Well, what we tend to do, we do randomized clinical trials where we randomize people. For example, Suzanne Friedman, who's now a professor at the University of Northern Iowa, who was at our conference, by the way, these last 2 days here in Madison, and I did a study way back when in the mid-1990s where we randomized incest survivors to a forgiveness condition or treatment as usual as they wanted to. And all of them, for the most part, said, no, I'm not going to forgive, but I'll be part of your study. They were being kind, but Suzanne in her gentleness said, come on in anyway. And so she went through a process of forgiveness with them, an hour a week, one-on-one for over a year. And at the end of that time, it kind of shocked the scientific world. The women who came to us all clinically depressed, which does make sense, right? Something as horrific as incest, went to non-depressed status. Those who did not have the forgiveness condition stayed clinically depressed. They then went through this program with Suzanne, and after a year, they went to non-depressed status, and the original group continued being non-depressed. And it was the strongest effect for incest ever recorded in the published literature. But that's just one example among many where people who've been brutalized by life, when they willingly choose to forgive, depression can go down, anxiety can go down, post-traumatic stress can go down, toxic anger can go down. And you know what goes up? Self-esteem. People actually start liking themselves more. And see, what we find, which is sad, is when people beat you down, a lot of people believe the lie and they start not liking themselves. And so when they forgive, they kind of stand up here and said, you know, I've just done something rather amazing, rather heroic. I was able, through my pain, to give a little goodness to this other. I'm a pretty good person. And their sense of hope for the future and self-esteem rise.
We're talking with Bob Enright right now, a licensed psychologist, professor of educational psychology at UW-Madison, and a longtime scholar on forgiveness. We're also taking your calls at 800-642-1234. Let's go to the phones right now. We have Patrick with us in Madison. Hi, Patrick.
Hello. I'd like to share the story. I had two parents that were very brilliant, but alcoholics and very abusive to each other. And the environment we grew up in for years was very terrifying and humiliating. And I carried around a lot of anger, a lot of grief, a lot of sadness carried with it into my adulthood. So I went through a process as an adult where I had to forgive my parents. My mother died of an overdose on the due date of my first son, my first child. And I was very angry with her and very sad. And, you know, I learned that sadness was a cover-up for anger and anger was a cover-up for sadness. But I went through a process of forgiveness. And in fact, in part due to Professor Enright. And, you know, the process is a lifetime process, actually. And but when I went through a very formal process of doing that, it was actually very freeing. And it was for me. It wasn't for them. It was a process that allowed me to gain more happiness. You know, I had PTSD from growing up in such a terrifying environment. And, I became happier and her spouse. I actually wrote a book about it called The Luckiest Boy in the World and was able to move forward. I mean, it's a very important process.
Oh, Patrick, thank you so much for calling in and sharing that. That's quite an incredible story. And Bob, when we are faced with a situation like Patrick was talking about, for me, I'm thinking, where do we start with something like that? You know, where do we start that process of forgiveness? What, you know, advice do you have? What have you seen that works as a starting point?
Yeah, the starting point is to first understand what path you're on. And we usually start with a definition, like you and I, Dean, just started, where you know you've been treated unjustly. The goal is to try and get rid of the resentment. And as Patrick showed you, he was miserable inside, tried to get rid of that through this offering of a little bit of goodness as best you can today toward that other person. And you may or may not reconcile. You won't excuse. You won't abandon fairness. Do you want to go on this journey? Many people say yes. Some say no. But if the person says yes, then we give people a homework assignment, and it's this. Try as best you can to do no harm to the one who hurt you. And that would include dragging their reputation through the mud, as an example. And see, we're not asking for some kind of goodness at first. We're saying refrain from the negative toward this person. And that itself can be rather curative. And when people begin that, then they can put on their backpack of forgiveness and start the journey. And I like what Patrick said. He said it's a lifelong journey, and it is a pathway. It's not like some kind of technique you do, and all of a sudden you do this technique for 10 minutes and you're done. It's more like a journey that you can keep on, and you keep perfecting in it, deepening in it, and your health improves.
We're talking about the power of forgiveness with Bob Enright, an emotional or educational psychology professor at UW-Madison and a licensed psychologist. We want to hear what you think at 800-642-1234. What questions do you have about forgiveness? Have you had to seek forgiveness from someone you've wronged? Have you received forgiveness? Have you forgiven others? Was it a tough process? What good has it done you? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Dean Knetter. We continue our talk with UW-Madison psychology professor Bob Enright. He's with us today to discuss the importance of forgiveness, a topic that he's studied for more than 30 years, forgiving ourselves, our communities, and more. We're also taking your calls at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Let's go to the phones. We have Hollis with us in Verona. Hi, Hollis.
Hi. Yes, am I on?
You are, yeah. Go ahead.
Oh, okay, yeah. I had a mutual friend of 40 years that I did work for, and we went to Acapulco, and I lent him on a second mortgage, you know, $50,000 that was supposed to be paid back in a month. He's an investor, and he never paid me back. So for 11 years, every month, I've been paying on that note that he never paid me back on, and he's living in Florida in a gated community, living the high life. So it's really hard to get over. Every month I go in, I'm trying to not be angry about it, but seems though I'm 67 and still working full time, it makes me rather angry.
Wow, Hollis, thanks for calling in and sharing that experience. And Bob, some anger, some resentment can come when those problems are going to go unresolved. What advice would you have?
Well, that is a hugely serious problem, Hollis, obviously, $50,000. And here's the kind of some of the next steps after you do no harm. What we do is then try to, as best we can, see who this other person is in a wider lens toward this person other than, in this case, stealing the money from you. And since you said this was a mutual friend, here would be some questions I would have for you. How has this person been hurt or misguided in his own life? What has made him stumble? Not to excuse. We're not excusing him. We're trying to see where he missed the boat somewhere with regard to this idea of justice, paying back what he owes. What happened to him so that he, in fact, has made this grave injustice? That's what we call the personal perspective. Then over time, we start seeing also, we go to what we call a global perspective, where we start asking this question: despite what he has done, does he have what we would call inherent or built-in worth as a human being? What do you see? Because you saw some friendship with him. What qualities does he have that go beyond the stealing of the $50,000? Not to excuse, but we want to see him as someone who has stolen. He's engaging in theft, but also someone who might have had a very difficult, confused life, and someone who also has a worth that we're not really focusing upon yet. And when we do that, when we do those two kind of exercises, that is part of a pathway, and it takes months to start seeing a person more widely than what that person did to us, that's when the anger starts loosening a bit and starts going down a bit. And that's when we start seeing that we're not actually going to be living with the effects of that theft the rest of our life. Do you see the difference between what he did and the effect of it? What he did, we can never go back. We can't ask the UW to make a time machine where we go back and change that, where you don't give them the loan. But what we're left with is the effect. And when we broaden our story about who the other person is, which is part of forgiveness, that's again part of the paradox of forgiveness. And we see that the anger goes down to some degree, or even some compassion for how he has not lived his life well. And that's when we ask someone to stand in the pain of what happened, which, Hollis, you're doing very well. You are already, from what I can tell, engaging in a process of forgiveness, because that's the next step of standing in the pain so you don't throw it back at that other person or displacing it onto others. And that's when, again, we see more healing coming in a person's life.
Hollis,
and that takes time.
Hollis, thanks for that call. We'll go next to Maria in Madison. Hi, Maria.
In a person's life. That takes time.
Oh, Maria, I think you may have your radio on. Can you hear us?
We'll go next to Maria in Madison.
I think, Maria, we have a little bit of a messy connection with you right now. Let's go next to Saul in Delavan. Hi, Saul.
Hi, and thanks for being able to listen to the program at the same time. I was thinking, and I know you two have mentioned not excusing, and I heard the word justice, but I think it's a bigger issue about what forgiveness is not, and that it's not a free pass, that it's not a thing that diminishes guilt. And in AA, Alcoholics Anonymous, there's a thing in there I think of as the anti-resentment prayer, to pray for the people you resent to have all the things you want for yourself, which to me is almost identical to a Buddhist meditation called Metta, where you pray for everybody to be well, happy, and peaceful, including people you have difficulties with. And then there's
Gotcha. Saul, we just have about a minute or so left here. I want to get Bob back in on this. Bob, what did you think of what Saul had to say?
I think he gave us some wisdom here, because he talked about Buddhism, AA. Dean, have been talking about ancient Greek philosophy and psychotherapy, and there's a thread that runs through all of these. So regardless of one's religious beliefs or non-religious beliefs, philosophical beliefs, humanism, whatever it is, materialism, realism, forgiveness is what it is across all of these. And Saul is right. We don't give up the idea of justice, but across all of these, forgiveness does seem to be the willing attempt to get rid of this resentment and offering goodness toward the other for the other's sake, and we're the one who benefits.
Well, Bob, thank you so much for your time today. Thanks for joining us.
It's been my honor. You take care, Dean.
You too. Robert Enright is a professor of educational psychology at UW-Madison. He's a licensed psychologist, co-founder of the International Forgiveness Institute. He's been studying forgiveness for over 30 years. He was with us today to share some of that research and the ways forgiveness can benefit all of us. Still time for you to share your experience with forgiveness. If you've forgiven someone, if it's taken time, tell us about the process. What made it click, and how have you felt afterwards? Has it been a positive experience? If you've sought forgiveness from someone, how have you gone about that? How's it worked? Let us know. You can email centraltime@wpr.org. That's centraltime@wpr.org. Coming up tomorrow on Central Time, the January 6th committee holds another hearing tonight, looking at what former President Trump was doing during the attack on Congress. A Wisconsin political scientist will look back at what we heard and what's next for the committee. And what is a campfire without some good food? On Food Friday, we'll look at some of the easiest ways to get cooking over the fire and hear your camping recipes. That and more coming up tomorrow here on Central Time.